Weather. This is the podcast where we explore the Earth's atmosphere and how we all connected through the weather and climate. We are your hosts. I'm Gemma.
Hello, and I'm Aisling. We're both meteorologists and weather presenters, and today we are at Blue Earth Summit. We're here actually for a couple of days, and we're going to bring some wonderful conversations to you from all the cool people that we get to talk to. Thanks for listening.
So I'm the Director of Brand and Communications at World Land Trust. So we're a conservation organisation based in the UK whose emphasis on all our projects is about land. Land being the most important aspect of any project. Apart from the other really important part is local people. We put local people at the heart of everything we do.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the work that you do?
Yeah, so as an organisation, we channel funds to partners in country. So we've now got 53 partners in 33 countries. And basically, all of the funds go to protecting land, so or restoring land. And we do that, we have different models for it. So you can do land purchase. So in some of our projects, for £100, you can protect an acre of forest that's under threat. We do long-term leasing, but we also do community agreements. So as an example, the one I'd really like is a project in Tanzania where we have funded 9 community forest projects. And what that's done is through our partner working with these local communities where these forests could be cut down for agriculture, large-scale agriculture, what we're doing is we're working with them and we've paid subsidies for them to manage that land in the right way. Which then means that they've still got their livelihoods, they still benefit from it, they can still use that forest. But the other benefit is that it works for the environment, so it works for climate, it works for the species, because you know we're losing species at the fastest rate ever in our history. So so for us, creating these reserves kind of has all of these benefits.
What's your motivation for your doing what you do?
My motivation or the organization's motivation?
So, your motivation.
So I joined the organization 13 years ago and I left my world of packaging. I used to do trend presentations. So I used to choose fragrances for products. So I'd go into a company and I'd tell them what the latest fashions were on the catwalks and what interior design was, what was happening in the trends and what, you know, what things should smell like. And one day I was kind of like, I'm just not interested in this. And since a kid, I've been a bird watcher. I studied illustration. So as a kid, my mum would say, all she ever do is find me drawing birds and plants and things like that. To the point of she had some black and white wallpaper put up, which has had plants and birds on it. And I went silent and she found me coloring it in. So for me, it was always about that. But what I wanted to do was use the skills that I'd inherited from this kind of corporate world and try and bring that into something I actually care about. And the God's honest truth is I thought I was going to do it for 12 months to take me away from what I was doing. But every day I kind of go in and I can have an email arrive that's, check out this picture and it's, you can't tell anybody about it yet. And it's like a new species that's been discovered. And then the next day I could be talking to a business that wants to support what we do. Or I could be talking to this lady earlier on who was kind of really questioning our approach. And I just had to talk through what, you know, this is what we do and this is why we're doing it. And genuinely it's about supporting local people to manage their land. So for me, it's really all about that. And having been to a couple of, or a few of our projects now is our partners. So they're just the most incredible group of people with so many different backgrounds, and they're trying to tackle the conservation movement in different ways. So there was another example. I was at a project in a partner in Guatemala, and I thought I was going to come back and I'd be talking to you lot and people on podcasts and people at these events about the amazing birds I'd seen, and you know, and I did see incredible things. But what they also do, and they're working, they have women's clinics that they're funding as well. Because what they know in those regions is that the women, like anywhere in the world, kind of run stuff. So they run the villages and they run the communities. And what they're doing is the government aren't providing the support. And, you know, and I've got a daughter. Well, I've got twins, but my daughter was only 12 at the time. And just the kind of seeing young girls who are having problems with childbirth kind of really struck a chord with me. So I promised them that, that I can't fund that actual project, but I know it's having a great impact on the actual conservation work, is that I would come back and tell that story, you know? So, and I think about that a lot, and it kind of makes the hairs on my arms stand up. But it plays an important part in everything we're doing. And for me, that's just, you know, that's probably what drives me. And we've got, you know, people who used to be ex-hunters who are been held up at gunpoint trying to protect, you know, now they work for the organization who are trying to protect parrots, parrot nests. You know, so I'm seeing all of these things, and that's what drives me. It's just being able to help deliver that and have that impact.
Your passion for what you do really comes across.
Good.
One of the questions I really want to ask you is, do you have a favorite species of bird?
I do.
What is it?
My favorite species of bird is a resplendent quetzal. It's actually a national bird of Guatemala. It's this beautiful kind of iridescent color. It's got these really long streamers for a tail. It's found in the forests of Guatemala and in places like Costa Rica and places like that, kind of Central America region. But it's my, so I've probably now seen getting on for 1,000 species of birds around the world. But that's the one I really want to see, that. There's that. And the other one is the Andean condor, because that's what made me fall in love. That, I could sit and go on grounds, but Andean condors was the first wildlife program I ever remember seeing. You'll be too young for that. It was a long time ago. That, but the one that birds that made me fall in love with environmental things is a tawny owl. And I know that exact tawny owl. And actually, I've got a painting that I did of that owl on my phone. So.
That's so amazing. People out there are always wondering, what can they do? If there's a message for them of what they could do, what would it be?
Something. The biggest thing, the worst thing we can do is nothing, right? So, but we can't do this unless there, and it sounds really cliche, but unless there's some collective action. So we talk about in the communications thing, so there's people who can fundraise and there's people who can provide funding, but also there's people like yourselves who are telling the story, but also we've identified there's a group of people and we just call them the amplifiers. So for us, we're a small organization. You know, we've got David Attenborough as a patron, we've got Chris Packham as a patron, Steve Baxter as a patron, but people still don't know about us. But what we need is we need people to talk. But what we need to do is we need people to talk and realize that things can be done, but we're at a point where it needs to happen. If not, we're going to get, you know, Attenborough talks about we're getting that point of irreversible climate change. But genuinely, I wouldn't sit here and do this if I didn't think we could do something. And that's what kind of keeps me going, because what I don't want to do is, you know, my twins are now 17, but I don't want them to not be able to see some of the things I've seen, you know, because species have vanished. But yeah, for me, it's do something. It can be amplify the message of organizations like World Land Trust. It could be donate to organizations like World Land Trust. It can be speak to your local MP, make sure they're doing the stuff. Hold businesses to account. So businesses that are saying what they're doing. So we all know of businesses who say they're doing stuff, but hold them to account. Make sure they're doing that in the same way as our governments and all our local MPs. But do something. It's do something. We need to mobilize. We don't all have to do kind of crazy stuff. But what we can do is we can do something. And that's probably the biggest thing I would say.
Some people are so scared about doing the wrong thing that they just do nothing. So they just need to take action, like do something.
But it's this thing, eco-anxiety, right? So people are so anxious about it that they freeze. Or they think, well, actually, the problem's too big. So, and it's, you know, bringing it back to World Land Trust, that's what we're trying to do as an organization. So it can be amplify our message, tell our story. But you can donate £5 and that will plant a tree. You can spend, you know, £100 will protect an acre of land in some of our projects. And to put that in perspective, I tried to buy half an acre of land in Norfolk, and that was 250,000. Needless to say, I didn't buy a quarter of an acre. But the £100 acre that we can do in some of our projects has got infinitely much more biodiversity than this area of land in Norfolk, you know? So, but it's, you know, but we're trying to give people all these different options. So it's going to be businesses that can support us and with different methods. So, you know, we've had companies in the past who, you know, put a meter of fabric into production. They protect a square meter of rainforest. It's about trying to kind of do all of these different different ways that people can support what we do.
Yeah.
But like I say, I think people have a tendency to think it's too big and they can't do anything. You know, it's like we talk about recycling, but that's going to have a benefit. Do it.
Yeah.
But what we've done is we've created a system that's far too complicated. But yeah, just do something.
So I was really struck by what you said about how young girls were struggling with childbirth. And through our podcast, the one thing that we keep hearing time and time again from everyone that we're talking to is that it's women and children that suffer the most in climate change.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, you know, one of the things we talk about is that we are trying to get some of the poorest people in the world to solve our problems, right? So, and that impact is in those communities is they'll see the changes, they're dealing with the issues, but the reality is in lots of those countries, they don't have the opportunities to do anything about them. You know, one of my favorite projects again is in Borneo, is actually, they set up a women's tree planting program, just women, because they wanted to do something, but because of the culture, they weren't allowed to, and they couldn't be involved in that. And now they've set up this tree planting program. And what's really interesting is it's by far the best tree planting program. They're much more successful than the men that are doing it, because they've got that nurturing side to them. And that's having the impact. And these trees are establishing and they're growing. But, you know, it's just one small thing. But I think we see it everywhere. And I realize that, look, I'm a white middle-class man working in an environmental charity and environmental sector. And there's a lot of people who are underrepresented in our organization or in general. But what's really interesting about World Land Trust is there's 44 members of staff, and I think there's 6 men.
Oh.
Yeah, so we've kind of bucked the trend on that. So, but that's not the same across the board. But if you look at probably the most high profile, if you take our patrons are amazing, absolutely amazing. They're all men. We've got some incredible people who support us. You know, like I said, we've got Attenborough, we've got Bagshaw, we've got Packham. You know, we've got the holy trinity of conservation in the UK. You know, this is like, it's amazing. But what I want to see is I want to see people from completely different backgrounds having that opportunity. There's a lack of diversity in conservation and in an environment. Obviously, not globally, because if you look at our partners, it's a very diverse group of people. But in the UK and in places like this, it's not a diverse group. And that's the challenge. But and it's really difficult because I can see that and I can understand that. But I'm really passionate about it as well. But I would love to see, more, probably a true representation of the world, you know?
Finally, what is the one thing you wish everybody knew about World Land Trust?
Wow. What's the one thing I wish people knew? So I'm going to give you the quote by Sir David Attenborough, which is, he said, the money given to World Land Trust has a bigger impact on the wild world than anything else he can think of.
Wow.
Is that enough? Does that answer the question?
That's amazing.
Amazing. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
No, I loved it. It's really good.
Absolutely. My name's Ellen Rickford. I'm with Rewilding Britain. We are one of three charity partners at the Blue Earth Summit this year. So we have this stand. Our CEO is currently doing a roundtable around sort of the future of nature finance and is speaking on a panel tomorrow. And we're just really here to meet people, make connections, hear about what other people are doing in the space, all of that.
So what is rewilding? If you've never heard the word before, what's rewilding?
Rewilding is quite simply the large-scale restoration of nature to the point where it can look after itself and us again. So that's sort of replacing ecosystems to their full function and returning native species, both flora and fauna, to the spaces where they no longer are.
Can you give us an example of a rewilding project? So I understand mostly what you're saying, but is there something tangible that we could think, okay, oh yeah, I can imagine what that looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. So I suppose, you know, when we think about nature, of course, you're not just thinking about one type of plant, right? So we all know that a flower needs to be supported by other areas of the ecosystem, whether that's the insects that pollinate it, or whether it's a healthy climate, a healthy sort of weather system that's going to be able to give it the rain and the sun and all the rest of it that it needs. And that's like one very microscopic piece. But on a broader scale, we're looking at full ecosystem restoration. So we're not looking at preserving individual species one at a time. We're looking at how do we protect and restore the entire web and the entire network of nature, including humans, that are required to sort of create that ongoing success for the natural world.
Have you got any examples of rewilding projects that have been done recently in the UK?
We have a network actually of 1,000 rewilding projects that sit within our rewilding network. We don't own any land or manage any projects on the ground directly, but we enable various sort of rewilding projects to take place through different mechanisms, funding, support, research. And also we have a sort of closed ecosystem of this network, which creates a sort of reciprocal source of support and information for each other. I could name 1,000, but one of our sort of flagship sites was the Neff Estate in Sussex, if you're aware of that. It's a huge site in Sussex, and they have reintroduced certain species that sort of make their ecosystem more complete, including beavers. And they've also ceased from using, for example, like strong chemicals in terms of pesticides, that kind of thing, which has allowed nature to bounce back on its own to some degree as well. And they have plants there that haven't been seen there for a long time, and then nature has just returned. So bird species that haven't been seen there for years and years since they've allowed that native flora to resurge, that native fauna has returned on its own to some degree.
It's an absolutely beautiful site. It's really, really lovely. It's just a nice place just to walk around and explore. It was beautiful.
We're also a big fan of beavers. We did a podcast once on beavers. They're fascinating.
They're amazing. They're honestly, the impact that they have on the ecosystem is just incredible. They really support huge increases in biodiversity through a number of the different ways that they engineer and sort of change the landscape around them and the riverscape. And they're really cute as well, which always helps, right?
What makes you want to do this job?
Well, a couple of things. I think I first became interested in it. I used to live in the US, and obviously the US has its own problems, but it does, in some areas, have more complete ecosystems that we're used to having here in Britain. So they have their large predators still on the landscape, for example. When I moved back to the UK, I really noticed the absence of some of that. And I really thought, oh yeah, we don't actually have this complete ecosystem that I'd grown used to being around when I was in wild spaces and green spaces out in the US. And I started looking into, why don't we have it? And is anyone doing anything about that? And I found out that rewilding was a thing. It was a movement. It was a concept. And I became really interested in it, just initially for that sense of a connection to the natural world. But then as I started to look into it more and more, I realized that actually the impact of rewilding went far beyond just sort of creating a more enjoyable space for me to be in, and actually improves water quality, improves soil quality, reduces flooding, reduces all of the sort of increases carbon capture, increases our resilience to climate change. So it has all of these capabilities quite outside of just
you know, my sense of wanting to be on a landscape that has wolves, for example. When I was looking at how I could put my energy into driving forward rewilding, I came across Rewilding Britain and found that they were sort of the only British charity who were focused completely on this movement and on this work, reached out to them, and the rest is history.
It's really lovely. So are you hopeful about the future?
Absolutely, I'm hopeful about the future. I think we have a lot of challenges to overcome, but we do have the capacity to change things, and to change things at the scale that we need to. We just need the right people to be making the right decisions at the right times, and that's what a lot of our work is around educating and advocating and influencing decision makers and helping them to understand the impact that the nature restoration through rewilding could have, not only, as I say, on sort of preserving the natural world and doing the right thing for nature, but actually doing the right thing for people. And there's a lot of research and evidence that shows that where rewilding takes place, you know, jobs increase, the economies improve. And of course, as I've said, there's also a huge impact that it has in terms of overcoming a lot of the challenges we now face associated with climate breakdown and nature degradation. So, so it's a powerful solution. We have big problems, but it's a powerful solution. So I believe in it. And I think there's a lot of reasons to be hopeful.
One thing. And what's one thing that you wish everybody knew about rewilding? Just one thing.
One thing that I wish everybody knew about rewilding, I think it's that the benefits of it go far beyond the local sort of the rewilding site itself. Once nature is able to function under its own power once again, the impacts of that scale exponentially. You know, nature has the benefit of millions of years of evolution behind it. It knows how to look after itself. It just needs to be given these small sort of helping hands to reconnect in the way that it needs to. So I would say that one thing that I would like people to know is the power of rewilding, and that really a little bit goes a long way. And so with that in mind, it's a mechanism by which we are able to make big difference with a relatively small effort. And so in terms of the sort of return on that energetic investment, it's a really useful place to start.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
No worries.
My name is Paola. I'm the media engagement manager for the Green Runners. We are an organization aimed at raising awareness on the environmental impact of running. And we engage individuals, we engage brands, and we also engage policymakers and politicians to improve the environmental impact of running in the world.
So where did this all come about? Why is there an environmental impact on running? So you might think putting on your shoes, running outdoors, there's nothing more environmental than that. So tell us a little bit about where, you know, where does all this come from? What is the environmental impact that we're talking about?
It does sound like a bit of a oxymoron, because one would think that running is inherently an environmentally friendly activity. However, when you start looking at the environmental impact of disposing of your use kit or your running shoes, or running to a race in a different country, or also the kind of fuel you have, so like snacks which are wrapped in plastic, or, you know, a very heavy animal-based diet might contribute to the carbon footprint. So we're trying to engage individuals to make different choices in their running and ensure that it's the more aware of the choices they make, and they don't need to be perfect. That we're not asking runners to be vegan. We're not asking runners to just like running in a jute sack. We just ask them to be a little bit more mindful of the decisions they make. For instance, if they enter a race, it really helps if they forgo the t-shirt or the medal at the end of the event, because it's in most cases merchandising that they won't use again, and they can choose to plant a tree instead. Conversely, they might swap their diet maybe for one day plant-based a week. So very small choices, very small decisions, but like very small marginal gains towards making a more informed choice towards protecting the environment.
So I know it's on the stall here that you've got all of these trainers. What's the environmental impact of trainers? What decisions can we make to improve on that?
I don't have the numbers, but trainers notoriously can't be recycled. And oftentimes there is a push from brands to buy a new pair of trainers under the guise of them like potentially hurting your tendons and your muscles if you're running them more than a few hundred miles. The truth is that the amount of miles that it takes for shoes to be for the thread to be consumed is very, very subjective. Some runners with a lighter step might take like 2,000 miles to go through a pair of shoes. And it's a lot better for the environment if we run in our shoes for as long as we can, because they can't be recycled, so that they just add to the landfill every time we don't buy a new pair. And we also encourage runners to, you know, if they buy a new pair, maybe use the old pair for gardening or for doing something around the house. Personally, I got a pair of running shoes that I passed down to my mom, and she's not a runner, so they look stylish. She's very happy with them, and so yeah, they've been around for 15 years by this point.
I don't actually know anything about running and policy making. So what do you mean by that?
It's more around advocacy in that sense. So ensuring that MPs are more vocal about the choices you can make as a runner, which could be as simple as encouraging your constituents to picking up rubbish when they go on a run, or maybe just as simple as not littering would be really great. So campaigns around protecting the environment around us when we go out for a run.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what the Green Runners do, and like if people are interested in learning a bit more, like what is the work that you're doing?
We provide support to individuals and brands about what choices to make, because it can be a very, very overwhelming first step to take, not, you know, wanting to be more sustainable, but also not knowing what to do. And also in a way, there is this idea that we are on our own and we are the only ones trying to do a little bit for the planet. We're trying to provide a supportive community. We're trying to provide enough resources so that individuals and brands can actually make informed decisions. And we share content on a regular basis. We've got newsletters. We're setting up webinars. We're setting up group runs. So we're trying to really create a community so that individuals feel like supported and nurtured into this journey towards environmental sustainability.
And by having a community as well, it means that people can learn from each other. So people can like pass on little tips that they might have learned, and it allows people to like learn a bit more, which is
Absolutely,
amazing.
Yes. And also, it's so, even myself, sometimes I feel like an isolated voice, and it's a lot easier to advocate when there is almost like a sounding board and an echo chamber around you. And you can actually feel supported in your decision to be an advocate for the environment.
And finally, what's one thing that you wish everybody knew about being a sustainable runner?
The main thing for us is that you don't have to do everything. You don't have to be perfect. That it's absolutely fine to make some really great choices and not some not so great choices. Nobody's going to call you out because you don't do everything. So just take one little step. And yeah, it's all we need. Just one step. Each of us taking one step.
Amazing. Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
So that's a wrap, Gemma.
That is. We really hope that you've enjoyed this episode from the Blue Earth Summit today. If you have enjoyed, please subscribe, rate and review the podcast. Follow us on social media. We are For the Love of Weather.
And we now have a YouTube channel as well.
Yes,
please follow us there for the Love Weather podcast. And as always, we just hope that you leave this episode loving the weather just a little bit more. Thanks for listening.
Bye.